This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, hosting comparative coffee and tea tastings all month at Pete's 7 Portland locations, including new locations on Hawthorne and in Vancouver. Details at PEETS.com.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KABU News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo Dillenderos-Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, a controversial old-growth forest is set to be clear-cut in a move pushed through by the Bush administration. The last high-ranking Enron official charged with fraud was sentenced to prison today. And Democrats in Congress are debating Iraq, but will they ever get around to asking the Iraqi people what they want?
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there are 2,863 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports 52,304 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. A new report by The Lancet places the civilian death count at more than 650,000 dead. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, November 16th, 2006. I'm Sun Lee.
And I'm Mike Monkwold. Walmart won't be able to build a supercenter in Gresham, a city hearings officer had ruled today. The dispute centered around how traffic will be leaving the store would approach a major intersection nearby. Walmart assumed that more cars would approach the intersection from the east, but couldn't prove it. The intersection is already close to failing, so a small change could cause long lines and block roads, a land use hearings officer said. Walmart could resubmit its application with more evidence, or it could appeal to the State Land Use Board of Appeals within 21 days, said Gresham City Planner Jim Wheeler. And this from the Oregonian.
Oregon is still waiting to be reimbursed the $2.7 million it spent to send Oregon National Guard troops in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. The money came from a pot of $16 million in state money for guard administration and armory operation. Brigadier Mike Caldwell says hopefully there will be some action soon because, quote, we need the money. Caldwell is saying the Federal Emergency Management Agency has promised to pay in full numerous times, but FEMA contacted the Oregon Guard this week asking for another form. Caldwell says it is ludicrous because they are being asked to do the same thing over and over.
The bad old days of old-growth logging may be back, thanks to a lame-duck Republican Congress. KABU's Lisa Loving has the story.
Despite a recent court decision that blocks logging in roadless areas controlled by the U.S. Bureau of Land Management, the agency today moved to ensure that more than 500 acres of pristine old-growth forest near Oregon's Siskiyou Mountains would be clear-cut. It's the first time federal officials have made old-growth timber available for logging in Oregon BLM land in more than a decade. The Bureau auctioned off the controversial parcel to a private company for pennies compared to its true value. The buyer, Rough and Ready Lumber Company of Cave Junction, Oregon, is expected to begin logging next spring. Home to the all but extinct northern spotted owl and numerous endangered species, the logging sale is in the Zane Grey roadless area, ironically named for the rugged Western adventurer novelist who wrote books in a cabin overlooking the Rogue River. Activist Rolf Scar with the Siskiyou Project says the Zane Grey sale is a throwback to the indiscriminate logging of the past, and questions remain about why Bush administration officials are so vigorously pursuing the timber even after losing on the roadless logging issue.
Of course, recently there was a court victory that stopped them from doing roadless area logging on national forests. So it seems like in their last 2 years of power, they want to try to crank out as much of these backwards logging projects as they can.
In September, a circuit court judge in San Francisco upheld a ban on logging roadless areas on BLM land that had been instituted during the Clinton era. The Zane Grey sale, in which the federal government netted about $485 per log truck load, will unquestionably result in a net loss to taxpayers. And that's nothing new.
You know, the BLM, contrary to a lot of what people often think, often loses money on these old-growth logging projects. So taxpayers across the nation actually lose when we log old-growth.
Activists with the Siskiyou Project say their next step is to heavily lobby U.S. Senator Ron Wyden.
Folks should give a call to Ron Wyden, who is actually opposed to the sale. He's mentioned that, you know, this sort of backwards old growth logging should be a thing of the past, and encourage him to step up and put pressure on the Medford District BLM to move ahead, to join us here in the future to find common ground and solutions for our forests. I want to point out that Senator Ron Wyden will likely be on the Forestry Subcommittee in the Senate in the upcoming Democratic majority in January. So he'll have some real power and some real ability to influence the backwards management of the Bush administration BLM.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving reporting.
A U.S. Forest Service purchasing agent wrote government checks worth nearly $650,000 to her live-in boyfriend. Then, the two spent the money on gambling, restaurants, and car and mortgage payments, according to a federal indictment. Deborah Durfee of Echo was arraigned yesterday in Portland on charges of embezzlement and theft of public money. Court documents and prosecutors said she drew the money from a national pool of fire funds, where it was overlooked among the nearly $1 billion spent nationwide on firefighting each year. As coordinator of a federal charge card program for the Umatilla, Malheur, and Wallowa Whitman National Forests in eastern Oregon, Durfee had her own charge card account and was authorized to write government checks to small businesses that cannot accept federal charge cards.
Marion County deputies say two teenagers have been arrested for killing a farmer's cow for beef. Donald Jones, a farmer who lives at Liberty Road in South Salem, told officers that someone had killed one of his cows, cut it up, and took a portion of the body. When deputies arrived, they found that the cow had apparently been shot and cut apart with two steak knives that were still at the scene. Deputies say 18-year-old Derek Becker was seen throwing what appeared to be the remains of a large animal's leg in the dumpster where he lives. Deputies found meat from the cow in Becker's refrigerator. Becker and a 16-year-old girl, also of Salem, were both arrested. The teens told deputies that they went to the farm with the intent of killing the cow for the meat.
Over 13,000 Oregon students have no home to return to after school, according to new figures released Wednesday from the Oregon Department of Education. That's up almost 2,000 students from the previous year. KBOO's Jessica Rink-Perry has more.
Home sweet home is just a figure of speech for thousands of Oregon students. New figures released yesterday from the Oregon Department of Education show that the number of homeless students enrolled in Oregon public schools in 2005 to 2006 increased 14%. Michael Anderson with the Housing Alliance says the increase to over 13,000 homeless students screams for help.
Families should not be living in cars and motels. If we want our children to succeed in school and life, they have to have a place to call home.
Anderson says the Housing Alliance is proposing the Housing Opportunity Agenda to the legislature next session, which calls for $100 million to help with housing for Oregon's working families, seniors, and people with disabilities.
The cost of housing has risen all over Oregon much faster than the wages that families depend on, and the consequence is a rise in homeless families.
For KBOO News, I'm Jessica Rink-Perry.
Police have arrested the principal of Malala High School on a charge that he assaulted his wife. Police say someone called them last week and reported that Kevin Ricker had beaten his wife so badly that she had to go to the hospital. Ricker's wife refused to press charges until Saturday, when police say Ricker agreed to come down to the station and be interviewed. The principal was charged with fourth-degree assault. Malala High School students say Ricker was back at work this week. The Willamette Educational Service District expressed concern about the case and planned to meet with the superintendent. Ricker and his wife also had restraining orders against each other.
The shooting of a man armed with a knife outside his family's home shows how difficult it is to deal with the mentally ill people in a system stretched to its limits, Eugene's police chief said yesterday. Chief Robert Lehner met with parents of 19-year-old Ryan Salisbury, who had anxiety and bipolar disorders. The meeting was held the day after police shot Salisbury during a confrontation in the driveway of his parents' home. Family members had called police because Salisbury was rampaging through the house and threatening to stab himself if they tried to stop him. Police said Ryan Salisbury ignored officers' orders to drop a large kitchen knife. Jeff Salisbury told reporters his wife watched as officers fired 6 beanbag rounds followed by 5 gunshots. Family members said they were not angry with the police and said they did not believe their son would have harmed the officers, according to the Eugene police chief. He said officers receive training for such situations, including a two-hour refresher course this month.
A King County deputy prosecutor resigned after using a racially charged name for a defendant in an assault case. During a court hearing with defense lawyers to take a statement from a possible witness, Shane Stevenson referred to the defendant as, quote, Big Nig, unquote. Stevenson later explained that after listening to tape-recorded jail calls, he thought that was the man's nickname. The prosecutor's office told him that language was not in keeping with the standards, and Stevenson will leave his job by the end of the year.
State revenue officials say Washington's economy may be slowing, but still is strong enough to produce a windfall of $57 million. This drives the state's expected surplus to nearly $1.9 billion. Governor Christine Gregoire will use a new projection to write a new two-year state operating budget next month. She told reporters she wants to use some of the surplus for education and health care improvements.
A new wave of Pacific Northwest storms has blacked out tens of thousands of customers in Washington state. Rain and winds blowing in off Puget Sound set a rainfall record in Seattle, even as emergency crews were setting out to assess damage from last week's flooding. The earlier flooding killed two people and forced hundreds from their homes. The new storms unleashed less rain, but wind gusts blew down trees, closed roads and bridges, and left many homes and businesses in the dark.
Washington County deputies arrested two men in Bethany today for possession and distribution of marijuana. Police seized more than 20 pounds of dried marijuana, along with packaging material, scales, and more than $2,000 in cash at the home where they both lived. Police arrived at the home and saw several men in an open garage with large amounts of marijuana spread out on the floor and in boxes. The two men, 18-year-old Nathan Kingrasa Tafone and 47-year-old Saya Seng Vangsori, are in Washington County Jail.
San Diego County gets its day in court today in its challenge to California's decade-old law permitting marijuana use for medical purposes. The county sued the state of California and its director of health services in San Diego Superior Court in February, saying a federal ban on marijuana trumps state rules. Two other California counties, San Bernardino and Merced, have joined San Diego as plaintiffs in the suit. All three counties have refused to comply with a state requirement that counties issue identification cards for medical marijuana users and maintain a registry of card applicants. The state attorney general contends California is entitled to pass its own state drug laws and legislation programs relating to the use of medical marijuana.
Jury deliberation begins today in the trial of a Texas teen accused of yelling racial slurs during a brutal sexual assault on a Latino teenager. Renee Feltz reports from Houston.
18-year-old David Tuck is charged with aggravated sexual assault. He's accused of attacking a 17-year-old Latino high school student during a party in suburban Houston where heavy drugs were used. In today's closing arguments, Tuck's attorney called witnesses who testified about the attack liars and asked for a not guilty verdict. Tuck and another teen are accused of stripping the victim naked and then sodomizing, beating, kicking, and stabbing him in an attack that lasted over 4 hours and ended with bleach being poured onto the victim's face and body. The victim was sodomized with a patio umbrella pole 1.5 inches in diameter. Tuck allegedly kicked the pole, causing massive internal injuries. Witnesses testified Tuck is a neo-Nazi skinhead prone to wearing swastikas and said he yelled out white power during the attack. The incident reportedly began when a 12-year-old girl told her brother the victim tried to kiss her during the party. Tuck faces 5 to 99 years in prison if he's convicted. Prosecutors did not seek a hate crime charge because it wouldn't change the possible punishment. The victim's family is working to change Texas hate crime law. In Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
Authorities say a UCLA police officer tasered an Iranian-American student in a campus library last night. Police say the student refused to show ID and would not leave when told to. They said he invited others to at the library to join in his resistance. Witnesses said the student had proceeded to the door before being confronted by officers who blocked his exit. Ultimately, the two officers on the scene tasered the student several times. Witnesses said bystanders repeatedly asked the police officers to stop. At one point, officers told the gathered students the gathered students to stand back and threatened to use a taser on anyone who got too close. One person caught the incident on a video phone and posted it on YouTube. The video captures the sound of the student yelling, quote, "Here's your Patriot Act, here's your abuse of power," end quote. The student was arrested for resisting arrest and obstructing a police officer, but was later released. The Islamic community, as well as many UCLA students, are already bombarding UCLA Chancellor Norman Abrams with complaints.
A decade ago, California voters approved Proposition 209, an initiative banning affirmative action in public institutions throughout the state. Since then, Washington and Michigan have passed measures modeled after it. The measure has had dramatic effects on college admissions, most notably in the University of California system. This year, only 96 African Americans entered UCLA, and only one black woman is expected to graduate from the law school in 2008. Free Speech Radio News' Leilani Albano reports.
News of the dwindling numbers of African Americans at UCLA has sparked protests on campus, which has seen black enrollment plummet to its lowest figures in 23 years. Yesterday, student activists, alumni members, and their supporters held a demonstration in front of a UC Regents meeting on campus, demanding non-compliance of Measure 209. One speaker at the rally compared UCLA's admission crisis to segregation problems in the South during the country's civil rights movement decades ago.
It was about 49 years ago that they had a situation called Little Rock Nine, where the federal government had to intervene to get nine African-American students into a high school in Little Rock, Arkansas. Well, we have our own situation here today. It's called UCLA 96, where they only have 96 students.
Daniel Skip Johnson, who attended the university in the 1960s and 1970s, says he is appalled by the lack of African Americans on campus today.
In 64, I came here and I was one of 100, the largest class of black students at that point. This is 42 years later, and now we have less people being admitted than were admitted in 64. That's absurd.
Activists say the admissions crisis is not only hitting blacks, but is indicative of a wider problem that affects other communities of color. Out of UCLA's 4,800 entering freshmen, there were 11 Pacific Islanders, 17 American Indians, and 103 black student transfers. Lucero Chavez is chief of staff for the External Vice President's Office and a manager for the admissions campaign.
And that's one of the things that has been a cause, or an effect, I should say, of Proposition 209, is that all these students are being denied access to public universities that their parents pay taxes for, that they pay taxes for, and we've seen the numbers decrease year after year.
Student organizers have lambasted the UC system for relying heavily on grade point averages and SAT scores as a basis for admission. Rather than challenge the use of standardized tests in the application process, affirmative action opponents are pointing fingers at Asian Pacific Islander students, who they say are overrepresented in the California public university system. Presently, APIs are 38% of UCLA students, although they make up only 12% of the state population. But organizers say not all APIs are making it into UCLA. California's Southeast Asian students suffer from lower enrollment numbers. As one example, the campus admitted only four Hmong students, including one undergraduate, two transfers, and one graduate student, bringing the total number to 25 on campus this year. Rather than fall into the trap of divisiveness, students of color at UCLA have shown their commitment to one another. Jason Osajima is a fourth-year student and director of the UCLA Asian American Coalition. He says the groups are working together on social justice issues affecting their communities and plan to do so in the future.
We're here for them, for this march, for this diversity crisis, and they're there for us, like during the HR 4437 rallies, like during our immigrant rallies. And I think we understand that this is not an issue of just affirmative action, it's not an issue of immigrant rights, but rather it's an issue of human rights and making sure that we live in a very equal and safe America.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
Democrats picked Representative Steny Hoyer of Maryland to be House Majority Leader today. Hoyer will be second in command to Nancy Pelosi, the incoming Speaker, and will play a key role in setting the Democratic agenda for the next 2 years. A 25-year veteran of Congress, Hoyer defeated Representative John Murtha of Pennsylvania for the title. Murtha, a decorated Vietnam veteran who opposes the war in Iraq, will chair the powerful defense subcommittee with responsibility for the war and the Pentagon budget.
Democrats are readying a maximum effort to raise the minimum wage. Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts said that increasing the federal minimum wage to $7.25 would be his top priority. On the House side, incoming Speaker Nancy Pelosi has listed an increase in the minimum wage as one of the issues that could be taken up during the first 100 hours of the next Congress. Most states have their own minimum wage laws, with some states having rates the same as the federal minimum wage, and some with rates higher than the federal minimum.
A Los Angeles hospital accused of dumping homeless patients on downtown Skid Row is facing criminal charges. Kaiser Permanente is among 10 hospitals under investigation for allegedly discharging homeless patients to the streets of Skid Row rather than to a relative or a shelter. The case stems from a March surveillance video showing a 63-year-old patient wandering Skid Row in a hospital gown and slippers. City prosecutors charged Kaiser with endangering dependent care patients and false imprisonment. It also sued Kaiser under a state law on unfair business practices. L.A.'s Skid Row, was one of the nation's largest concentrations of homeless people. Police have long since suspected that medical centers and law enforcement agencies from other areas dump their homeless people there.
Homeless sex offenders are exempt from laws requiring them to register a change of address with state officials, Maryland's High Court has ruled. The Maryland Court of Appeals said in a pair of unanimous rulings that it would be impossible for the homeless to comply with that provision of the state sex offender registry. The rulings overturned the convictions of two sex offenders in Montgomery County for failing to update their addresses. Attorneys for the government said they would seek a new state law to address the issue. How many people the ruling affects is unclear. A person staying in a homeless shelter for any length of time has an address, the High Court has said.
The staffing process in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice is under question in the Senate Judiciary Committee. During a hearing this morning, former Justice Department employees accused the Bush administration of stuffing the division with political appointees and driving out experienced career attorneys. Yanmei Xie reports from Capitol Hill.
Joseph Rich had spent decades as a career attorney in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice until last year, when he felt the climate in the division had changed dramatically.
It was evident in a hostility to career employees who expressed disagreement with political appointees or were perceived as disloyal. And it led to a serious breakdown in communication and cooperation between political employees and career section management.
Rich left the department and joined the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law. He says he was not the only one who took flight.
Over 54% of the voting section attorney staff and 65% of the employment section staff, as well as a large number of appellate staff, have left the division or transferred to other sections.
Rich says this exodus of career lawyers happened since Bush took office. Wan Kim is Assistant Attorney General overseeing the Civil Rights Division. He told Republican Senator Arlen Specter, chairman of the judiciary panel, that the numbers cited by Rich are not accurate.
This division has approximately 350 lawyers, Senator, and the division attrition rate for the past 12 years has been about the same historically over that past 12-year period, and that is approximately 12 or 13% of our attorneys leave each year.
According to a Boston Globe article, since 2003, the number of lawyers with civil rights law experience has declined within the Civil Rights Division, and those with conservative credentials have gained more posts. Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, the top Democrat in the Judiciary Committee, questioned Wan Kim of the division's hiring approach.
Why are we having now political or ideological considerations overtake career and competent considerations?
Senator, I don't hire people based on ideological considerations. I hire people based on their talent, their excellence, and their commitment to the work that we do in the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division.
In the hearing, the Department of Justice is also under criticism for not doing enough to prosecute discrimination against African Americans. Ted Shaw, president of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund.
The division
has seen a precipitous decline in the number of cases brought on behalf of African Americans, particularly in employment involving systemic discrimination, but also in other areas.
The Bush Justice Department filed 4 voting rights lawsuits on behalf of any minority group. In comparison, the Clinton Justice Department approved more than half a dozen such cases in its last 2 years alone. Michael Carvin is a practicing lawyer who worked in the Justice Department under the Reagan administration. He says the comparison simply means the Clinton administration was overreaching.
Let's look at, as I said, the Clinton administration's record in front of the Supreme Court on the Voting Rights Act, which was, you know, no better than that of the Washington Redskins, certainly. I mean, they consistently lost on the most important voting rights cases of the term.
Senator Leahy is set to replace Specter to become chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He pledges to conduct more oversight hearings on the Department of Justice. Ye Meixie for Free Speech Radio News on Capitol Hill.
A bipartisan bill represents the best shot in years to improve the safety of drugs the FDA regulates, witnesses told lawmakers today. Some of the bill's provisions, including a temporary ban on consumer advertising of newly approved drugs, echo proposals made in a September report. The report found the FDA cannot track the safety of new drugs nor respond quickly to problems for want of money, people, and power. The bill would require pharmaceutical companies to devise safety plans for new drugs. It calls for more disclosure of the results of drug trials in human subjects. It would also give the FDA the authority to require companies to carry out safety studies of drugs once they are on the market.
Participants are wrapping up the United Nations Global Climate Change Conference in Nairobi. Environmentalists say progress was made, but didn't go far enough. And as Leanne Caldwell reports from Washington, D.C., a shift in congressional power could mean a change in U.S. environmental policy.
Representatives from around the world met in Nairobi to set a global plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Some progress has been made. Most participants believe the Kyoto Treaty is reducing greenhouse gases, and most believe new guidelines must be implemented after its expiration. But Gordon Shepherd, director of global policy at the World Wildlife Foundation, says there is much resistance from both developed and developing countries to move forward.
So far, at least, that we haven't got here the mandate necessary to feel confident that whatever comes out between now and, I would hope, 2008 is going to be strong and satisfactory.
The United States has not been pushing the reduction of emissions. They aren't a signatory to the Kyoto Treaty, and the chair of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, James Inhofe of Oklahoma, says he doesn't believe in global warming and dismissed the work being done in Nairobi.
It's a brainwashing session with only one side present there, and it's an effort to get their mission accomplished.
He says the science behind global warming is far from proven. He hosted 3 scientists in his Capitol Hill office to disprove its basis. But Senator Inhofe will no longer be chair of the Environment Committee because of the shift of power in the Senate. Instead, it will be Senator Barbara Boxer, a Democrat from California. She says global warming will be one of the top issues she'll address.
We are going to put this global warming matter before the American people, hold extensive hearings, and move toward legislation.
Senator Inhofe suggested he would block much of Senator Boxer's policy, either in committee or on the Senate floor. The climate change conference in Nairobi is expected to wrap up tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Presbyterian leaders announced their decision to dismiss charges against a minister accused of breaking church law by presiding over the marriage of 2 women. The Constitution of the Presbyterian Church reserves marriage for a man and a woman, although ministers may bless other types of holy unions. The church has been struggling to stay unified despite differences over whether the traditional biblical view condemning gay relationships should stand. Presbyterians who support same-gender unions say the Bible's social justice teachings on inclusiveness should prevail over what they see as an outdated view of homosexuality.
President Bush has nominated former California Republican Congressman James Rogan for a federal judgeship. Bush nominated Rogan for a seat on the U.S. District Court for the Central District of California. Rogan was defeated in his San Gabriel Valley district 6 years ago after attaining prominence as a House manager during President Clinton's impeachment trial. Rogan has been serving since earlier this year as a Superior Court judge in Orange County after he was appointed by California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Rogan served from 2001 to 2004 as director of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. He left Congress after his 2000 loss to Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff in an $11 million contest that was the most expensive House race in history.
The former chief accountant for Enron Corporation received a 5.5-year prison sentence yesterday. That made him the last member of the energy trader's upper echelon to face judgment for a fraud that cost thousands of Oregon employees their jobs and left investors billions of dollars poorer. Richard A. Causey, 46, pleaded guilty to a single count of securities fraud in December, weeks before he was to face trial of conspiracy and fraud charges. Government lawyers have called it the most complex white-collar prosecution in history. Causey's sentence follows prison terms recently handed to two other key Enron figures. Former chief executive Jeffrey K. Skilling was sentenced last month to 24 years and 4 months, while one-time finance chief Andrew S. Fastow was sentenced in September to 6 years. Company founder Kenneth L. Lay died of heart disease in July, less than 2 months after a jury convicted him and Skilling of misleading shareholders and employees about Enron's mounting financial problems before its December 2001 bankruptcy.
Clear Channel Communications Incorporated, the nation's biggest radio station owner, said today it has agreed to acquisition for about $18 billion by an investment group. The transaction would be one of the biggest deals in which a company has been privatized. It showcases the vast sums that buyout groups have been able to assemble to acquire public companies. The investor group is led by Thomas H. Lee Partners, LP, and Bain Capital Partners, LLC. The company said in a regulatory filing that it doesn't expect any senior management changes or significant layoffs.
The current time is 5:32, and now, time for another highfalutin daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
George W.'s No Child Left Behind program is being perverted into No Bush Left Behind. You might recall Brother Neil Bush from his Hi-Yo Silverado days when he headed a Colorado SNL that went broke, costing us taxpayers $1 billion to bail it out. Now, Neil is in the education game. As honcho of an outfit called Ignite Learning, he goes around to school districts hustling a computerized learning center dubbed CAL for curriculum on wheels. Made up to look like a purple cow, it's wheeled into classrooms where it uses jingles and cartoon videos to teach students. Each cow costs $3,800, and at least 13 school districts have used No Child Left Behind money to purchase them. That money is primarily intended to help disadvantaged kids learn reading and math. Yet Neil's cows don't teach either of these subjects. Curious. Additional money to place cows in various schools has come from such Republican stalwarts as Reverend Sun Myung Moon and such longtime Bush benefactors as the Saudi Arabian Oil Company. Also, Neil's investors come from afar, including millionaire businessmen from Kuwait, China, and Russia. Odd. Both Daddy and Mama Bush are investors as well. Barbara is so committed to the enterprise that when she made a donation to help Hurricane Katrina evacuees who had moved to Houston, she required that all of the money be spent buying Neil's cows. How charitable. Ignite's ethics are also on display in a company video. A teacher named Lori testifies how Cal did wonders for a young student named India. Only, Lori is really not India's teacher. She's Ignite's marketing director. Ignite says Laurie was not lying, just role-playing. This is Jim Hightower saying, so is Neil, pretending that Ignite would be getting these federal dollars in sales, even if his name was, say, Neil Jones.
This Jim Hightower Common Sense Commentary is brought to you by the Marijuana Policy Project Foundation. To learn more, visit www.joinmpp.org or call toll-free 1-877-JOIN-MPP.
Stay tuned for Proverbial Perspectives with Mickey Honeycutt and the kids from Self Enhancement Incorporated. At 7, it's Good Times with Reggae Bob. For tomorrow's weather, the clouds are parting a little to let the sun out tomorrow in the Willamette Valley and the Columbia Gorge, with highs in the low and mid-50s. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The Pentagon that gave taxpayers a $434 hammer and a $600 toilet seat cover now has a $500 million travel booking system that is bypassed by more than 8 in 10 users. Senate investigators found the Pentagon's web-based product fails to find the cheapest airfares and offers an incomplete list of flights and hotels. The investigators found that Defense Department travelers are contacting travel agents to find their hotels, flights, and rental cars, and then using the system to enter those choices. The Defense Travel System was designed as the Pentagon's version of an internet travel site. A senator plans legislation to force the Pentagon to use travel agents, saying military staff is wasting too much time using the cumbersome new system and therefore erasing any cost savings.
More than 2,000 Marines are being deployed to Iraq's volatile Anbar province this week, U.S. Central Command officials said today. The Marines, from the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit, based at Camp Pendleton in California, have been offshore on ships in the Persian Gulf. They will be moved to Iraq on orders from General John Abizaid, head of the U.S. Central Command. He referred to security challenges in the vast Sunni-dominated province when he testified yesterday before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Marines and soldiers have been fighting militants in towns along the Euphrates River in the province west of Baghdad, and many of the U.S. troops who have been killed in combat died there. A security group operating in Iraq said Thursday it was investigating an incident involving employees after an ABC News report that up to 14 people, including four Americans, were kidnapped in an ambush of a convoy of contractors near Nasiriyah. Crescent Security Group, which operates out of Kuwait City, did not provide details, except to say an incident occurred in southern Iraq.
Senators are preparing a bill to extend the tenure of the Inspector General charged with oversight of reconstruction projects in Iraq. The standalone bill would keep the Inspector General in Iraq for 10 months after 80% of Iraq reconstruction money has been spent. The Inspector General's term will expire soon, and authors of the measure say it would be a waste of money if the oversight job ends before the work is complete. Senators Russ Feingold, Susan Collins, and Joseph Lieberman sponsored a similar measure, which was later attached to the Military Construction and Veterans Administration spending bills, which passed the Senate on Tuesday. The senators have sponsored the separate bill to increase the chances of its passage into law.
Raed Jarar is an Iraqi blogger and the director of the newly created Iraq Project by Global Exchange. KBOO News caught up with Raed this afternoon to ask him important questions, such as, what should Democratic leaders in Congress do now?
Unfortunately, there are so many people, Congress members and decision makers, who are very confused about how to change the course to the better. Shocking call from Democrats to divide Iraq into three states or three regions. And this, according to most of the Iraqi decision makers and Iraqi public, is a recipe for a long-term, full-scale war. If the U.S. actually supported dividing Iraq and keeping the military presence there, it's like the recipe to destroy the region furthermore. So there are so many possibilities to have bigger disasters by changing the course to another wrong one. And I think the first thing that we have to be discussing before we reach to discussing the details of the new course is the process to how to reach to the new course. If the new course will be created by more meetings, closed meetings in D.C. and London, and meetings among American decision makers without involving the Iraqi voices, I doubted that we can actually reach to a different course that will function the right way in ending the war. So bringing the Iraqi leaders' voices and bringing the Iraqi population's voices into discussion now and letting them have a say in what should be happening in their country and what has to happen in their country is essential to creating the right course. And unfortunately, until this moment, we can't see any signs of this. There are some few signs that the Iraq Study Group, which is a group led by Baker and Hamilton, and which is the group that even the new defense secretary is a member of, this group seems to be promoted as the new magic wand that will find the solutions to solve the Iraqi situation. And this group did not have real contact with Iraqis. So most of the Iraqi decision makers that I've been in contact with, whether they were in the Iraqi elected parliament or whether they were within the top officials, and other people from the civil society and my relatives and as friends, they don't think that the Iraq Study Group is authorized to speak on behalf of the Iraqi people. So we have, like, you know, a problem in representation of Iraqis, and it's their country after all. It's not that it's irrelevant to see what are the Iraqi needs for ending this occupation, how to end it and when to end it, and what to do with Iraq as a state after that. I think unless the Democrats realize this void, this need and lack of Iraqi voices in the decision-making process, unless they realize this as soon as possible, I fear that we will end up having yet another unilateral plan that will lead to more destruction and death in Iraq.
A Marine Lance Corporal apologized today for his role in the killing of an Iraqi man before describing some of the frustrations his squad faced in the weeks before the incident. Lance Corporal Tyler Jackson of Tracy, California, faces up to 15 years in prison, but will likely receive a far lighter sentence because of terms of a pretrial agreement. Jackson was in a squad of 7 Marines and 1 Navy corpsman accused of kidnapping and murdering 52-year-old Hashim Ibrahim Awad last April. Jackson said his squad carried out a plan to kidnap and kill Saleh Gawad, a man they suspected to be an insurgent. It was not until weeks after the incident that Jackson said he learned that the man who had been killed was Awad, who prosecutors say was a father of 11 and a former police chief.
The Shiite-led Interior Ministry issued an arrest warrant today for the top leader of the country's Sunni minority, a move certain to inflame already raging sectarian violence in Iraq. Interior Minister Jawad Balani, a Shiite, announced in state television that Harith Dari was wanted for inciting terrorism and violence among the Iraqi people. Moderate Sunnis have been threatening for weeks to leave the government and take up arms. If that happens, it would likely lead to a full-fledged civil war and make it much harder for U.S. troops to withdraw from Iraq. The warrant was issued on a day when at least 49 Iraqis died violently, and the U.S. military announced the deaths of 4 more American soldiers. Sunnis and Shiites could not agree on whether all hostages had been released from a mass abduction in Baghdad 2 days earlier, and one man said he'd been beaten by the kidnappers.
Democratic Republic of Congo presidential candidate Jean-Pierre Bemba says he will use all legal channels to contest the election results that gave victory over to incumbent Joseph Kabila. The Congo Independent Electoral Commission has declared Kabila the winner with 51% of the votes in the bitterly contested election with Bemba, who garnered 41%. Peacekeepers are already poised in the capital city of Kinshasa with extra troops on hand in case of trouble. Free Speech Radio News' Joshua Chalimpa has the story.
Supporters of Joseph Kabila dancing to music by Congolese singer Charles Mwana after the announcement that Kabila has won the election.
How do you feel now that Kabila has won?
Grateful, I'm telling you, wonderful surprise that Kabila has won this election. For us, the Congolese, we are very happy because he's the only man who really can put Congo in unity, peace, and everything nice. He said reduction, he really, that's his problem because people doesn't like him because of his bad behavior, bad manners. In case you know, of anything like a war, I think Kabila is so powerful that you can destroy him.
The election is the first in Congo since the country attained independence from Belgium in 1960. But Bemba and his supporters said the election was rigged in favor of Kabila. Bambi Wilson, a supporter for Bemba, says most of the rigging took place in Kabila's home area in Kasai Province.
He's saying that vote was rigged, it was not transparent.
Na Kasai, na Lubumbashi, pe na Kindu.
He says it's the side of Kasai, Katanga, where that's Kabila's homeland, vote was rigged.
But European Union observers have said the election was free and fair. Bambi says the solution to this is for Kabila to form a unity government with Bemba. Like many Congolese, Bambi does not want war to restart in his country. Bemba, a former rebel leader, has been Kabila's vice president in accordance with the power-sharing agreement that ended the war in that country. Tensions are still high in Kinshasa with allegations that Bemba is arming youth in the capital for war. Didier Kouwa is a Congolese diplomat in Kampala.
Bemba is the one who trying to disorganize Congo. He's the one who is trying to disorganize Congo to give those switch boy the guns for killing people when we need peace. So UN mission, they need to call Bemba and to stop him to not, give the street boys guns for killing people for nothing. They are now trying to start war in the capital, trying to fight with Kabila's soldiers. And what I say, Kabila is not very organized with UN mission in Congo, MONUC. And I know that they are going to handle those problems. They are going to handle the problem and they set them down.
The president-elect has appealed for calm in the country as his supporters celebrated his victory in the landmark election. However, Bemba says the election announced Wednesday does not reflect the truth on the ballot box. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting for the
Sudan is to return more than 2 million southern Sudanese who have been living in slums around the capital, Khartoum, for over 20 years. The United Nations will give over $100 million to the program. The move comes 2 years after Sudan signed a north-south peace deal to end Africa's longest civil war. Under the deal, southerners have the right to vote on whether the south should break away from the north by 2011.
Israeli air forces raided a series of targets in the Gaza Strip today after Palestinian rocket attacks killed an Israeli resident and injured others in an Israeli border town. Free Speech Radio News' Rami Al-Maghari has more.
This morning's raid followed a call by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to resume peace talks with Israel. Medical sources reported Thursday that at least 5 Palestinians were wounded after Israeli warplanes attacked a number of Palestinian houses in different parts of the Gaza Strip. The raid destroyed houses in the Shapura neighborhood of Rafah City, the Jabalia town, as well as the Shatta refugee camp in western Gaza City. The latest Israeli army attacks on the Gaza Strip came less than 24 hours after the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert ordered a swift response to the killing of one Israeli woman and injury of a few other residents by Palestinian homemade rockets in the nearby town of Sderot. Palestinian resistance fighters resumed firing rockets after the Israeli military offensive Autumn Cloud killed 95 Palestinians in 1 week. The majority of the mostly civilian deaths occurred in Beit Hanun, a northern Gaza city close to Sderot. For Professor Ann, I am Rami Al-Mirari, reporting from Gaza.
A state appeals court chastised President Bush for intervening in the case of a condemned murderer born in Mexico, as well as 50 other Mexican-born prisoners. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals rejected the argument from Jose Ernesto Medellin that he was denied legal help guaranteed under international treaties. Medellin, who spent most of his life in Texas, was sentenced to die for the rape and murder of 2 teenaged girls. In February 2005, Bush ordered new state court hearings for all 51 prisoners. The Texas court said yesterday neither the Constitution nor any act of Congress gave the president the power to issue such an order. The decision means Medellin is not entitled to additional review of his international rights claim.
Public school teachers in Oaxaca, Mexico, went back in their classrooms today. The Education Workers Union began a strike on May 22nd, calling for higher wages and increased funding for the school system. Teachers later added the resignation of Governor Ulises Ruiz to their list of demands. The federal government has agreed to an increase in education funding. Teachers say they will continue their fight for the removal of the governor.
Young African women report that they are increasingly using condoms with their partners, according to a study published in the British journal The Lancet. While abstinence rates changed little, the study found that condom use more than tripled from 1993 to 2001. Women make up more than 60% of adults infected with HIV in sub-Saharan Africa, according to UNAIDS. The study found the use of condoms might be further accelerated by linking them to family planning, since 60% of single women in Africa use a condom to avoid pregnancy. Researchers said the study provides evidence that the U.S. AIDS program, which focuses on abstinence, has been misdirected.
A Vatican summit led by Pope Benedict XVI reaffirmed mandatory celibacy for priests today, rebuffing a high-profile crusade by a married African archbishop. Emmanuel Milingo of Zambia incurred automatic excommunication in September when he ordained four married American men as bishops in defiance of the Vatican. When Milingo was excommunicated, several Vatican watchers said the Holy See was worried about the possibility the charismatic archbishop could start a schism. The Vatican did not cite any figures, but there are estimated to be at least 100,000 married priests worldwide, with about 25,000 of them in the United States. Proponents of easing the celibacy requirement said it could help ease the shortage of clergy in many parts of the world.
India's cabinet today approved a measure that would allow established non-profit organizations and educational institutions to operate community radio stations. Jean Parker reports from Pune, India.
The cabinet approval clears one of the last legal hurdles preventing direct community access to the airwaves in India. Today's decision came after India's group of ministers issued a recommendation last month to expand the presence of community broadcasting throughout the country. Under the new regulations, nonprofit organizations that have worked in a community for at least 3 years can apply for a radio license. The government said political parties and trade unions would not be allowed to apply. The cabinet authorized the Ministry of Information and Broadcasting to finalize details of the policy before issuing licenses to new stations. Local community radio advocates, along with UNESCO and the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, began pushing for a policy change in 1995 when the Supreme Court of India said the airwaves are public property. Programs on health, women's issues, language preservation, literacy, and farmers' rights will likely soon be broadcast throughout the country via community radio. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jean Parker in Pune, India.
Then more than a third of the financial aid promised by the United States to help Lebanon rebuild from last July's Israeli war has been spent. Much of the reconstruction is centered on Beirut and in southern Lebanon, where Hezbollah is virtually a state within a state. Hezbollah spurred post-war reconstruction by offering initial cash payments of up to $12,000 for Christian as well as Muslim families who lost their homes. Randall Tobias, the director of the U.S. Foreign Assistance, recently visited Lebanon and acknowledged Hezbollah was dealing with humanitarian needs. Tobias said the U.S. assistance has covered a wide range of projects, including clearing oil spills, assisting fishermen, removing pieces of unexploded bombs, helping farmers, and rebuilding bridges.
President Bush is in Asia today on his way to Vietnam for the annual meeting of the Asia-Pacific Economic Corporation. This is the first trip abroad since the Republican Party lost control of Congress in last week's elections. Free Speech Radio News' Seoul correspondent Jason Strother reports that the president may use his tour of the region to show that despite setbacks at home, he still has political power.
President Bush will arrive in Hanoi on Friday, making him the second U.S. president to visit Vietnam since Bill Clinton established diplomatic relations with the communist nation in 1995. Analysts say the president needs to show that he still carries political capital after the Democratic victory on November 7th. But convincing his host may not be so easy. Despite dropping Vietnam from the State Department's list of countries that prohibit religious freedom, a bill that would have normalized trade with America's wartime enemy was shot down on the floor of the House of Representatives earlier this week. Speaking today in Singapore ahead of the APEC summit, Bush voiced his support for a Pacific Rim free trade zone and cooperation in finding alternative sources of energy. Bush also reaffirmed America's commitment to stopping North Korea's nuclear weapons program. Envoys meeting on the APEC sidelines have already announced that the next round of multilateral talks will begin sometime in December. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul, South Korea.
Hundreds of people from the eastern and northern coasts of the Philippines have fled their homes after a tsunami warning was misinterpreted. The Philippine Institute of Volcanology and Seismology issued a warning shortly after an earthquake struck near Japan. They advised people to keep watch for changes and canceled the warning later on that evening. However, residents reported receiving cell phone text messages from people warning of 40-foot waves, which caused panic. Disaster officials call for a better information system.
Riots have broken out in the Tongan capital, Nuku'alofa, over delays in political reforms. Pro-democracy groups overturned cars and attacked government buildings. The government had proposed putting reform ideas to a subcommittee for consideration next year, but pro-democracy activists want changes in place for the next general election in 2008. 10,000 Tongans took to the street in May last year, demanding democracy.
The World Food Program says efforts to transport aid to people in Nepal are being hampered by the Nepalese Transport Union. The agency is appealing to the union to allow convoys to reach over 50,000 people affected by drought and over 100,000 Bhutanese refugees. The Nepal Transport Union has been reportedly disrupting the flow of transport across Nepal for the past week. The World Food Program is delivering assistance to over 225,000 people hit by drought in mid and far western Nepal.
Parents in northern India's Uttar Pradesh state are refusing to vaccinate their children against polio after a local newspaper claimed that the vaccines could cause cancer. Health officials described the claims made by the local newspaper as false and mischievous. The officials are stepping up efforts to encourage parents to adopt the vaccine. Polio has been largely eliminated by much of the world, but still exists in Nigeria, India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. And that's the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 16th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203. Or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. And that goes for news tips as well. Call us with your news tips at 503-231-8032, extension 203. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. My name is Mike Munkvold, and I'm your assistant producer. Our wire editor is Jenna Thompson. Our audio editor is Jessica Rink Perry. Special thanks to reporters Jessica Rink Perry and Lisa Loving. Our engineer is Jeff Lovell. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving.
I am Sun Lee, and coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., here are the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30 a.m., it's Ani and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. At 9, it's Marlena's Electronic Salon. She and Ed Goldberg will talk about politics, culture, and the future of democracy. And at 10, Marlena will interview Howard Lyman, rancher-turned-vegan activist and author of No More Bull, The Mad Cowboy Targets America's Worst Enemy, Our Diet. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, the guests are writers Alice Walker and Isabel Allende. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, listener-sponsored community radio station. Volunteer with our humble broadcast by calling 503-231-8032, extension 203.
Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-time evening news and public affairs director. We're looking for someone with news and public affairs skills, writing, editing, production, and training experience in working with volunteers. The job requires the ability to work under deadlines, to work under pressure, and to work evening hours. The ability to work with a wide variety of people in a multicultural and cooperative environment is essential. For more information and to get a job application, please contact Chris Merrick, care of News Director Hiring Committee at KBOO, or go online at www.kboo.fm for an online job description. KBOO is an equal employment opportunity employer. Deadline is Friday, November the 17th at 5 p.m.
Okay. Welcome, 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 everyone. This is another edition of Teen Talk. I'm Mickey Honeycutt, and it's great to be back here at KBOO. Our studio guests today are some wonderful eighth graders from SEI Academy, and I would love for you guys to introduce yourselves.
My name is Reggie Robinson. I'm eighth grade, 10 SEI Academy, 13 years old.
My name is Ashley Duke. I attend SCI Academy. I'm in the 8th grade, and I'm 13 years old.
My name is Javari Tyler, 8th grade, SCI Academy, and 13 years old.
My name is Cherie Smith. I attend SCI Academy. I'm 14 years old and in the 8th grade.
Okay, and we have a special guest here. Her name is Miss Denise Boston.
Denise, can you say hello to everyone out there?
Hello, I'm Denise Boston. I'm a math teacher at SEI Academy.
Thank you. Today is a special, special type of topic. We all have to deal with it and we for the rest of our lives, and we're going to be speaking on relationship, what it means to us. So if I can just get someone's definition of a relationship. Reggie?
Well, exactly what my relationship, my definition of a relationship is someone like who really cares about someone or who really has like a secret or anything, like they could keep up with each other and
This is Ashley speaking, and my definition of a relationship is a strong bond between two or more people that has traits like communication, honesty, loyalty, and things to that effect.
Nice. All right.
My name is Cherise, and a relationship is a bond between two people, like Ashley said, that cares about each other unconditionally and that has a bond that pulls them together and makes sure that they have each other against the world.
Nice. This is Javarier, and a relationship to me is holding a high standard for each other and respect for each other. Nice. So you guys are saying that your definition of a relationship is a strong connection. Is that fair to say?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Ms. Boston, what is your take on relationships? What's your definition of a relationship?
Well, I'm really proud of the children, and it seems as though, yes, a relationship is the strong bond between people and how you maintain it. And I think the main thing is trust, willingness to trust each other.
I totally agree with you. We're going to be talking about the different types of relationship we have and our role in it, you know, what we play, what role we play in each of our relationships. And I want to start off with parents, you know, my relationship with my mom. You guys know my mom, right?
Yeah.
Oh, it's an incredible bond. But I knew that it wasn't always like that. We were bonded, you know, since birth and everything like that. But it got richer as we got to know each other and we worked and we poured things into that relationship. So I just, when I think of my mother, I get such like warmness inside because she's an incredible, phenomenal woman. And I give her the most honor and respect in the world. That's enough about me and my mommy. I can go all night with that. But I want to know about the role you play in your relationship with your parents or guardian.
This is Ashley, and like my relationship with my mom is good. It's better than my relationship with my dad is. And like my role, my relationship is like just learning to trust her and know she's not gonna lie to me and know that when she tells me things, she's telling me them for a reason, not just to hear her own voice. And like like with my dad, it's learning that at first, maybe he wasn't in my life, but he's trying to be, and just learning how to, like, let him in and not, like, push him out and give a little, meet him halfway.
My bond between my parents, well, they're not here anymore, but my bond between my parents were really, my mom was really close. Me and her had a good relationship and everything, but the opposite of Miss Honeycutt's with my dad, it seemed like ours disintegrated. As we got to know each other instead of enriched.
Okay. Reggie?
This is Reggie again. I don't really have a relationship with my mom, but with my dad, because my parents are split up right now, so kind of been going through a hard time right now, but I've been living with my dad since, and we've been having conversation to conversation because he's with another woman now. And so I'm time to time.
How do you feel about that?
How I feel sometimes, I think. Before this, I used to think that this woman was taking the place of my mom, but I found that she really isn't. She just really trying to, like, help me. And my dad, we have some talks sometimes, and, like, I have, like, cries sometimes because it be hurting me inside. And, it's just, like, real hard sometimes, but I've been going through it right now.
So you're still continuing to build your relationship with your dad?
and, yeah. and adding on new relationship as your dad's friend is in your life now.
Yeah, she got two girls, one seventh grade, and the other one is like little girl, she only four.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes they might be annoying and stuff, but I hang out with them a couple times, talk with them, laugh, we play around, yeah.
So you're starting to build a relationship mm-hmm. with added on siblings, right?
Yeah, there was a big move. Me and my dad moved into where their spot, and I got my own little room, and yeah.
Okay.
She's been there for me.
And this is Javari again, and I live with my dad and my stepmom, and me and my dad have a good relationship, and we talk about, like, sometimes I talk to him about, like, school, how I'm doing, and I talk to my stepmom about school, and when my dad is good, it's all right, and my stepmom, I like her, she's like a mom to me, and, yeah, I could just talk to both of them about anything. I don't have nothing against them.
All right, so good job, you guys. We're going to go next to siblings. Who has siblings? Brothers, sisters, like cousins, you know, your age. Oh, everybody. So we're going to start with you, Ashley. What is your relationship with siblings?
Okay, so my relationship with my siblings is different with all of them. Like, on my mom's side, I just have my one brother. And my relationship with him, like, when we were younger, I didn't really get to know him because he lived in a different state until I was a certain age. And we got to know each other better and everything. But then a few years ago, he got diabetes. And then since then, a lot of stuff happened. He's a father now and everything. So I don't see him that much, and I haven't talked to him in a long time. But, like, I feel like if I were to see him tomorrow, I would be like, this is back to the same old thing. And then my relationship with my siblings on my dad's side, I have a lot, like 12 of them.
12?
Yeah.
12?
12.
Wow.
My second to oldest sister, I get along with her very well. She's the one that's trying to tie me back into my dad. Like, every time I go over her house, I'd be like, okay, I'll come over, but I do not want to see dad. And then, like, she'll trick me or go over his house or something like that, or go to my grandma's and he'll be there. And then, like, my sister, the one that's a year older than me, I get along with her so much. I talk to her all the time. Yeah, it's my buddy.
This is Reggie one more time. Yeah, I have two brothers. One's 1 year older than me. Other one's a year and a half younger than me. And my little brother, we go to the same school. He's sixth grade academy. And sometimes my brother lives with his mom, so we don't really chat a lot. We don't really get along too much. We fuss a lot. We fight. But I still love him and respect him because that's my brother, and I'm supposed to love him. I ain't supposed to hate him because we got to stick through with each other. And, like, in the future, if I need him, if I fight with him too much, he ain't going to be there for me. But if I know if I stick with him, I love him to death, and he be there for me. And my other brother, 1 year older than me, he's my half-brother. He's my half-brother because we got the same dad but not the same mom. He lives in Las Vegas. But I still wish he'd be up here with me right now because I like to live with him, too. I love him, too, so I just wish he was up here, too.
And this is Javarier, and I have 8 siblings, and, well, 4 of them are my step-siblings. And, well, I have one real brother. He's like, we have the same mom and dad, and I get along with him good. We share the same bedroom, so we kind of do a lot of arguing over the TV remote and stuff. So we do a lot of that. And then I have 2 half-sisters, which we have the same dad but not the same mom. But they live with their mom. But I get along with them. They're younger than me. And so they live far out, but they come stay with us for some of the weekends. And then my stepbrothers and sisters, I get along with them good. And then one of my stepsisters, she's 4 months older than me, but we still get along, and we go to the same school, and we same grade. And the other 3, one's out of school, and one's in high school, and one's in elementary, and I get along with them real good. So I have a great relationship with them, too.
Sharice?
I have 4 other siblings. I have 1 whole sister, but I look at him as more than just my half-sister. I have 3, my other 3, Loretta, she's, She lives here, and I love her, like, so much. But after she been getting sick and stuff, it seemed like our bond has been growing because she's been getting sick and stuff. And I love her to death and everything because she's my only older sister that I have down here that keeps us in contact, all of us talking on the phone and stuff. And everybody together, it seems. And my other two sisters, one's in Arizona and the other one's back east. And my sister Sarah, me and her don't got that big of a relationship together because we argue most of the time about just things that go on and we don't get along, but I still love her.
Okay. All right. Well, personally, I have four younger sisters. And being the oldest, I'm like second mom. And mm-hmm. I wasn't like, you have to do. Have you guys ever felt like you guys do what I say? If you guys got younger ones, you feel like you're like the second parent or something like that?
Uh-uh. Yeah.
Well, who else? Can you talk about that?
Well, my sister, she's older than me. She's 15, I'm 14. But it seems like ever since my mom passed, I've been taking care of her, it seems like, because everything she calls on me for, basically, she says, where this at, where that at, how do you do this, how do you do that, it seems more of that than anything else.
And my brother, I think he kind of tries to control me a lot, and he tries his best to, but he tells me to clean up my room and stuff, which I do sometimes, and my two little sisters, I try to help them out too. Like when if they make a mess, clean it up, you know, but yeah.
Yeah, I remember growing up it was all girls in the house, and I'm the oldest, and I liked my stuff really neat. You know, I had all my stuff that I worked for, and it seemed like every day my little sister or another little sister would get in my stuff, and I was like, oh, that used to irritate me so much. But what I want to know is, what irritates you about your siblings sometimes?
Ooh. The thing that irritates me about my sibling is they bossy, like real, real, real bossy. And like me, I'm a person where I'm straightforward. You're not going to tell me what to do. I don't care who you are. So if you try to tell me to do something, I'm going to look at you and be like, no. And they're older than me, so at the same time, I have to, like, respect them. But then at the same time, it's like, uh-uh, you know? And then the other thing that gets my nerves about them is, like, let's say my mom tells my brother to do the dishes. He'll be like, hey, mom said you have to do the dishes. And then I do them. My mom comes in like, why are you doing the dishes? I'd be like, my brother Dante said you told me to. She's like, no, I told him to. And I just be so mad. He laughs about it like it's funny or something.
And I think that what gets on my nerves is, like, my older brother, he irritates me a lot. He, like, he'll always, like, I'll ask him, stop making a noise, and he just keeps, like, just making a noise constantly. And then my two little sisters, they just sometimes annoying, too, because I'd be wanting to just sit down, watch TV, they be trying to get up and play, I'd go outside, and I'd be like, no, because I'm not that active. So that's what irritates me.
What irritates me about my little brother is, like, every time I go over his house sometimes, he acts like he the boss to me because it's his own room now. Because it used to be our room, but now it's his room. Always bosses me. Like, if we play the game, oh, you can't play that. You got to ask me. I'd be like, oh, I don't be telling you that when you come over to my house.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just what irritates me sometimes. It just makes me mad. And sometimes he cries over little things. And I'd be like, what is you crying for? And he just do it, and I get in trouble for it. Like, if I beat him in a game, he'll start crying. And my mom will say, why are you messing with that boy? Leave him alone. I'd be like, I'm not even doing nothing to him. He lost in the game. He crying.
That would be irritating. I remember going through that with my little sister. I mean, she was such a sore loser. And everything would be like, and it's like, you're the oldest. You know, it's like, fair is fair, though, you know.
Sometimes he like,
go ahead.
Sometimes when we have to clean up, I don't usually clean up a lot because my mom tells me to pick up my stuff. I pick up my stuff and be like, man, you don't never help me clean up the room. I'd be like, it's your own stuff. You don't never come over to my house and clean up my room for me.
boy. Go ahead, Sharice.
Yeah, my sister that I live with, she thinks she's the boss of me because she's older, and she thinks she can tell me everything and try to be my mom sometimes. She thinks that everything she tell me is right, and it's like the Bible that I gotta live by it and everything. And that's what irritates me, because I made it this far, and I don't need somebody that's just 13 months older than me telling me what to do.
God, I love this talk on relationship, but we have to break. You're listening to KBOO on your FM dial, 90.7. We'll be right back with Teen Talk.
J'avais fait mon idée. J'étais parti pour chercher cher, pour mourir à bout de mon sang.
Comment ça va? Oh, tu peux te marier si tu veux. Tu peux
si tu veux. Si tu te maries, moi je te dis, sera comme le chat qui cause la souris. Oh, et là-bas, comment ça va?
Right, all right. Welcome back to Teen Talk. We left off talking about parents, relationship with parents, and siblings. And now we're going to get into relationship with our teachers. And we are so fortunate to have Miss Boston here with us today and to give her perspective on the relationship with teachers. So we have student side and we have teacher side, and we're going to have some good conversation right now. It's going to get good, you guys. So you guys start off. I'm going to ask you, Reggie, about your relationship with your teachers. Tell me, maybe give me a story or tell me your experience with a wonderful teacher and maybe another one with a not-so-wonderful one.
Oh, probably my wonderful teacher probably be Miss Boston and Mr. Reinhold, because they work hard on me, because they know what we're about to step into, high school level stuff, and they work hard on us, and they keep us moving up, and they want us to do more stuff, and like, they sometimes give us hard work. Miss Boston do, because that's our math teacher.
Mm-hmm.
She gives us a lot of work.
You're not saying that because she's here, are you? He's sincere. He's sincere. Go ahead.
And Mr. Reinhold, he might give us some hard work. We started off with some kind of easy work, or probably to me, but I don't know anybody else, but it's easy. We started on our states. It's our social studies class. Yeah, those are like our favorite teachers. Like, yeah, and our... probably my least favorite teachers probably had to be.
What subject? When you were in elementary?
That's our science.
A science teacher. Science is pretty hard, and that's pretty hard to teach, too.
Mm-hmm.
My name is Ashley, and I don't have a favorite teacher. I have a different relationship with all my teachers. Like, my math teacher, that's my food teacher. Want some snacks, some chips, something. Like, the day when somebody stole my lunch and everything, and I was just in cafeteria crying, mad, throwing stuff, just angry.
Wait, can I just interrupt you? One thing you guys gotta know about Ashley is she loves her food.
Do not take
away her food. Am I right?
Yes.
So for someone to steal a meal ticket or to take something away, as far as food wise, that is a sin. So I just had to let everybody know how passionate you were about your food. But go ahead.
Very passionate. So I was crying, and she came in and got some chicken, everything like that. And you know, we ate. My social studies teacher, he like talks our lingo. You can talk to him about anything. My science teacher, she's like helpful. Like if you really do not get something, she'll help you out. And then my language arts teacher, she gives us like work that I've never done before, so it kind of like challenges me, because there's been classes where I didn't feel like I was challenged. But my hardest class would probably be science or math, because my math teacher is always on me. Like, I'd be mad at her at the time, but then I know that it's just because, you know, she cares about me, and like, she's always thinking a step ahead. Like, we're in eighth grade, but we're taking ninth grade math classes, so she always thinks ahead.
And this is Javaria, and I think my two favorite classes are math and social studies, because they know what I could do, and they've been here for 2 years, and so they know what I could do and what kind of work they could put me as. And my favorite teacher is Ms. Boston, because she knows me, and my unfavorite class I don't like to really, it's kind of hard for me, is probably, I have to say, science. Because I'm a visual learner, and she just probably gives us packet most of the time and tells us in the textbook and tells us the page, and I get lost real easy. So then I just find a good partner I could get work with. But, yeah, I still get kind of good grades in her class, so, and I still like the teacher.
Well, for me, math class is probably one of my math class in social studies is one of my easiest classes, because it's like I do want to take my algebra credit into high school, and that's why I be stressing most of the time about my grade in there, because if I got that, then in senior year I can take just like two classes and be done with and stuff. So that's why I don't want to be more productive in math and stuff. But probably my hardest class that I have to pass is language arts. It'll probably be the one that gets me because I don't really like to read stuff that's not relevant or interesting to me. And that's like what gets me off track and stuff because I will space out completely and immediately if it's not interesting. I'll find something that's more interesting to me and work on it the whole class period than do work. So that's what I need to work on, I guess.
And Ms. Boston, could you please tell us the types of relationships you have with your students?
Well, it seems like all I do is feed them, but it's a good relationship. I think it's important to make a difference between the teacher and the subject the teacher's teaching, because they are two different things. Just like teachers look at each individual student as people first, and then what they can do. And I think that's a strong piece, because people and people make relationships, not people and subjects. So if you don't like science, it doesn't mean you have to hate your science teacher. Or if you don't like math, it doesn't mean you have to hate your math teacher. What you can do is get your math teacher or your science teacher to help to double team the subject that you don't like. So find something nice with it. Like, I teach a lot of kids, so I find something great with each child that I teach. And it's sincere. You know, some people have great dimples and a smile.
What about
some have a crazy laugh that will just infect the whole class. Some just have their ways with things, you know, and jokes. So you gotta love people for who they are and what they bring to the table. And if you look, you'll find that everybody has something good.
I'm so glad you said that, Ms. Boston, because it really is really helpful to attack the subject and not the teacher. I like that. Do you guys agree with that?
Yeah.
I just love the way you put that.
I do that sometimes, though, but not intentionally. Like, because I don't like a subject, I'd be like, ooh, I don't like that teacher. But it's really not teacher, it's just I don't like the subject.
See?
Yeah, like, or if they're trying to get, if they get passionate about it, that's what really gets them in their emotions, because if we don't like that subject and they're putting their life into the subject, that can get somebody really passionate about what they do.
As Reggie, sometimes when I'm bored or tired, I say these things is boring. Like, sometimes we get some hard stuff and I be tired, be like, man, this is boring. I don't feel like doing this.
Mm-hmm.
I put my arms in my shirt and just fall asleep sometimes, or I put my head down, but the teacher say, boy, if you don't get up, like my social study teacher, he always tells me that.
When in class, like, if I don't, like, get the subject, I will get, like, really, really silent, and or I'll just, like, play around, or just, like, get sidetracked and turn around in my seat and put my legs over the chair or something and just talk to people and get other people off track, and I just don't like to do that, but it just, when I'm bored, I do that in class.
Go ahead, Reggie. Go ahead.
Sometimes I like to crack jokes in class, be a class clown, like, crack a joke and try to make everybody laugh just to get people off task. Like, I'll say a joke to somebody and, like, get spread around, or I'll say it out loud.
I just thought of a question I wanted to ask you guys. Do you guys think, that you, 2006, 2007, kids, middle school at this time and age, do you guys think it's harder for you than it was, like, say, for me or Miss Boston? And if you do, why?
It's Charisse. Yeah, I think it is much harder because there's more things in life, economically, and everything else has increased different ways. It's been different for a decade now. I mean, everything, every day something changes, every second of every day something changes. Like when you walked out the house, a flower might have grown, and then when you get home it might be dead because of the rain. So everything changes because of something in our community. And from the knowledge now that we have, everything is upgraded. And most people from the 60s, 70s, y'all time period.
Thank goodness, Ms. Boss.
our education has upgraded, and it's harder nowadays from the stuff that we learn than what y'all have learned in the past.
All right. I got some hands waving. Jafaria?
I think it is way more easier than, like, back, because we have more technology, like higher calculators and stuff, better calculators, and, like, textbooks that will have a whole lot more information in them, and that there's just a lot more we can learn now as the teachers are going, like, back to probably college or something and getting their thing pumped up or whatever. Their degree pumped up. And just, like, they're just getting smarter so they can come back and teach elementary, middle, or high school or whatever one they want to teach.
Okay, Ashley.
I think that just like what Cherie said, that with time, things change. And I think yes and no. I would say yes, I think it's easier for us because, like Javaria said, we have the technology to make things easier. You know, back in the way, y'all had them little typewriters. You know, now we have computers and stuff like that. And, like, also, I would say no because to make things easier for us, you guys had to pave the way.
Ooh.
You know what I mean? So, like, yes and no. So,
yes. Wow. Well, thank you for that compliment.
Go ahead. Even though you did say it was either you and Javari said it was easier, I know they had to pave the way, but since it's easier and we have more technology, that means everything has advanced from then. Like, new stuff has happened. Like, Pluto's not a planet no more because it doesn't fit the
criteria.
The criteria of it. And when they was taught, Pluto was a planet. There was 9 planets, not 8. So everything is changing, and we have more things to learn than they did. Like, because my auntie, she's 67 years old. She didn't do algebra and all that. She did it probably, she probably was starting the beginning of it, pre-algebra, but she never did algebra and stuff from her memory.
What I was going to say is it's getting harder now because back in elementary, teachers used to hold your hand and stuff. Everything used to do. They used to be there for you. Oh, it's okay.
Yes.
You need to not do it no more. Now, as we getting older, these teachers is getting harder and harder on us.
We do something.
It's like, get out the class. If you don't want to be here, get out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Ms. Fawson, can you tell us why is that?
Yeah, I want to know because,
really?
I mean, yes, I always
put it on the spot. We put it on the spot.
See, I don't understand. See, because I look at it like this. You know, life changes. That's just a part of living life, okay? So even though, like, you use that analogy about the flower being there in the morning and then in the afternoon it's gone, well, that's in your day, but that's in my day, too. So as you're growing, I'm growing, too, to stay on top of that game. So I'm going to know something about the history because I lived it. Okay, I heard you. 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. I heard that. Okay. But even so, it's all going to happen, and we're all learning together. Some history things that we know, it's all back there. You know, of course, I might know a little bit more about that. But as we're learning, as they're doing the new planets and whether or not Pluto is a planet or not a planet, I'm learning that right along with you. So there is a lifelong learning piece there. But it's a good thing. I don't know if it's changed. I don't know if it's harder or better.
Do you feel that you have to be harder on your students now to get them prepared for the future?
Oh, absolutely, because they're not being prepared for today. Mm-hmm. I have to prepare them for their tomorrow, whether I'm going to be here or not. And it's not just getting the right answers. It's knowing the process. It's how to problem solve.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to get you ready to solve problems that I don't even know that's going to exist yet.
Yeah.
You don't even know. But you got to have the technology in your mind to handle
it. Oh, awesome.
Okay.
Well, to add on what I just said about teachers, something about what Ms. Boston talks about every time in our class, like, people that don't want to do the work. She got another little half because she split the class up because people being silly now. And so she split the class up. She got people doing little easy work that don't want to do the work to get ahead of what we're about to step into.
Mm-hmm.
So they're mm-hmm. doing work that we should probably be doing now, but yeah. she's trying to get us ready for high school. And those kids ain't ready for that, so that's why she got that half of the part.
You know how you said that it might be harder and better, but it's probably harder now. But I don't think nothing that we learn is better, and I don't think how our school is going, our school system and everything is working out, is better. It's not for the better, because if it was for the better, we wouldn't have changed it at first. So I don't think it's working out for the better how our schools is set up now. But I do think since our school is different, since we are a charter school, we are trying to do our own thing, I think that we it is working out for the better. But this is just middle school. Everything is erased till we get to high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that our middle school teachers right now are helping us, because when we get in high school, the teachers are not going to give us as much leeway as they do now, and they're not going to give it to us easy right now. And they're just going to expect us to have the homework on time, and if you take the notes, you take the notes, and if you don't, you don't.
Okay, and with that, we're going to take our break. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 on your FM dial. We'll be right back with Teen Talk.
J'ai fait un rêve que vous étiez noyé. Voilà mon frère dans un joli bateau. Voilà mon frère dans un joli bateau. Au bal ce soir, ma frère me mènerait. Oui, oui, ma soeur, allez vous habiller. Le bal commence, Hélène met à danser. Le banc défense, Hélène va au ballon. Comment mon frère va-t-il le se noyer? Comment mon frère va-t-il le se noyer? Non, non, ma soeur, tu apprends à débrouiller. Non, non, ma soeur, tu apprends. La cloche de l'homme a mis à sonner. La mère demande pourquoi la cloche sonne-t-elle. La mère demande pourquoi la cloche sonne-t-elle. Ta fille Hélène, elle s'est laissée noyer. Ta fille Hélène, elle s'est laissée noyer. Ma fille Hélène, elle m'a désobéi. Ma fille Hélène.
Okay, and welcome back to Teen Talk. We've been talking about relationships, and we've been covering relationship with our parents and siblings and teachers, and I just love the last segment. But now we're going to get into relationship with the opposite sex, boyfriend, girlfriend. Or, you know, are we ready for that in middle school? Are we ready to date in middle school?
My personal opinion of it is I think that it's a personal decision. If you think you're ready for a relationship with someone, then I think that if you're mature enough and you feel like you think you're ready, then go on ahead. But just think of the consequences and think that if it leads to things like sex, things like that, just know that even when you think you're ready, you're more likely not really ready. It's just in your mind frame at the time you thinking you're ready. And so if you're going to decide to do something like that, you need to be 150 million percent positive that you're ready and not just do it on a spur of the moment thing.
I got something to say. You might not say this is a debate, but I think something else is needs to be put into place, because not just you think you're ready. I think if you think you're ready, you know you're ready to do that.
Okay, are we talking about a relationship?
It's everything that you have an opinion on, or everything you think about, really. If you think you're going to do anything with anyone or get into a relationship with someone, I think you must think you're ready enough to be involved with that person. And whatever you do with that person is you and that person's business. But if some things result in that, I think that's like you need to be ready to take the consequences for your actions.
Okay, Javaria?
I think when you're in middle school, I don't think you should be like, you could have like a partner or whatever.
A boo.
What's a boo?
Like a girlfriend, and for boys, a girlfriend, and for girls, a boyfriend. Yeah. So they have like boos different ways. So.
But ain't it just more than just going out?
Well, I think when you go out, like you guys like go to the movies or something, like go out. But
I'm not talking about a date. I'm talking about, like, without going out to the movies or something. I'm talking about just talking on the phone about y'all days and stuff, like, really interacting with each other.
Oh, I understand you. Like, because, like, I can see when you, like, walking down the street and you guys are holding hands, walking to the store or something, and having other people talking to you about, are you too young, and stuff like that, and how other people react, and it's their business living alone or whatever. I can see that when you're walking down the street. But, like, when you're, like, in, like, when you're on the phone and talking and stuff, that's between you two, and you guys don't have to put it on a blast in school or whatever.
I'm talking about if you out in the street, and it's the difference, because some people take it as the difference if you're out in the street and then in public. And on the telephone. When you in public and then you on the telephone, two different things come out sometimes. So would you be real about yours?
Like, what do you mean real?
I mean, like, positive about your relationship. Would you be willing to commit to that person and just that person? And would you really be there in a relationship with them?
Yeah, I mean, if you go out with one person, I don't see why having five other girls on the side. What's the point of having that? I mean, what's the point of that when you could have one better one, and you could have just that one that you could talk to, and you don't have to worry about all this other drama?
So my question was, should you date in middle school?
I think you should, because that'll get you ready
for high school dating
and know for fellas what type of woman you want.
Okay.
But Javaria, but if you want to date a girl, don't choose no girl that you don't want to date that don't want to be with you. Why would you choose a girl that you don't want to be with?
Because if you choose a girl that gets on your nerves and and like yells at you, and like preppy girl or whatever, and you don't like those type of girls that gets on your nerves, what's the point of dating them when you can find somebody that you really want to be with?
That's more your preference.
Yeah. What kind of person that you would like to be with?
And what's your definition of dating, and what's the extent of dating?
Dating is not just going to movies, not just going out to get a grub or whatever. It's more than that. It's more than you got to communicate. You got to be trustworthy. I mean, like, if somebody's out in the street and you ain't there with your boo, I mean, like, do you trust him to be with another female? Like, I mean, just as friends when you're not there. I mean, it's a personal decision to trust that person and have faith in them that they ain't going to do something with that person or cheat on you or something like that. It's more than just going out to movies. It's just faith. It's trust. It's loyalty. It's more of that. It's more of a commitment.
Going out to eat.
to add something about that, about dating. If you wanna date somebody, you gotta have that responsibility about doing that stuff. If you don't got responsibility, you ain't probably ready for that stuff. If you don't got trust, you don't got neither.
Reggie, can I ask you a question?
Have respect.
Mm-hmm. Well, Reggie and Javar, speaking of responsibility, yeah. Ask y'all true for a question.
Uh-huh. Yeah, go ahead.
Why y'all be so cheap nowadays? I mean, hold on. If you have the heart to come up to me, ask me to be your girl, fly me around all your friends, yeah, that's my girl. Woo-woo-woo. I mean, I can't supersize my meal. I mean,
okay, but like, we're only in middle school, so should we have to be paying for your clothes and your food or what? I mean, because when we go, we're only in middle school.
Okay, I'm gonna ask about sex. Do you think middle school age kids should be having sex at this age, and why?
I'm going to reinstate this. I said that I think you should do whatever you think you're ready for. Like, I'm not saying it's okay for you to have sex. I'm not saying it's okay for you to go around just sleeping with everybody if you feel like it. I'm saying that it's all right. To do what you think you're ready for. I'm saying that's either for relationships, sex, no matter what. If you think you're ready for it, it's not considered right, but it's if you think you're ready for it and stuff. And it's not from getting pressured into by your boo or anybody else. It's if you yourself think you're mentally ready for it and stable for that kind of a relationship with someone else.
Speaking of sex, if you ready to have it, use protection, because I know none of these middle school kids is ready to be a father or a mother.
Thank you. No deadbeat daddies.
Good. Especially, job. I know none of these little girls or little boys, young men and young women are going to drop out of school just to take care of some kids.
Preach. Well, thank you.
Well, I think the opposite of Sharice. About having sex, cause you're too young for that, and I don't think you're ready for it when you do that. Cause if you have a baby, I think you're just gonna leave it on your parents or your grandparents or your guardian just to hold on to that baby, cause you have to go to school and get your education, and I don't think you'll have the money to pay for the baby's diapers or anything. So I don't think that's the point. You should do that or not.
My personal thing on it is, for me personally, I'm like, no, I'm not ready for that. No, I'm not ready for that. But if somebody else is ready for that, I think that in society nowadays, people point the finger, be like, oh, she's nasty. Oh, she's raspy. Boop, 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 boop. And a lot of that stuff goes off on the females. Like, mm-hmm. If a boy is going around doing that, then they don't say anything about it. They just be like, oh, yeah, he's real fly. He's cool for that. And then when girls do it, oh, she's nasty. She's nasty. So ladies, if you're going to decide to do that, or if you already done that, just know the consequences. You can get diseases, pregnancy, I mean, all different things. I mean, you just giving away your treasure. Like, this lady told me one day on the bus, she was kind of drunk or whatever, she was like, the best present you can give somebody is your virginity, because that means you're pure and that you save yourself for them and only them. So think about that, and when you think you're ready, think, am I really, really ready? And if your answer is still yes, think again. And if it's still yes, think again. Because it's a really, really, that's probably one of the biggest decisions you'll make in your life.
And I have to interject, because you guys all know my perspective. No, middle school, you are not ready for sex. Exactly. I mean, bottom line, you're not. That's my opinion. I work with students all the time. And because you don't know what the consequences are. And these consequences are huge. And like Reggie was saying, pregnancies, diseases, you said your virginity, you can never get some of that stuff back, and stuff that you do get, you don't want. I want to have Miss Boston's perspective on this.
thought I was going to be quiet. Mm. Well, see, I think there's more than just the act. I think there's the emotional responsibility that comes after it, with or without germs, disease, or pregnancies. So are you emotionally ready to deal with this? Are you emotionally ready for someone not to want to see you again? Are you emotionally ready? I'm just saying, if it was all drug-free and all germ-free and pregnancy-free and nobody else knew but you and your boo, mm-hmm. Could you still deal with the fact that now you've given something so personal, something so private, and they don't care?
Don't appreciate it.
And you're the same 13-year-olds that don't bring pencils to class. I need to know these things.
I couldn't do that to me. Oh, it's Sharice again. But I personally could not do that. It's me. And what I meant before was there is consequences we do have to deal with after the fact that you did that. You can't be putting your baby off on somebody else if there is something that concerns them. You can't be putting your AIDS or anything else on someone else and stuff. But I personally couldn't deal with that. Like, if I gave something so precious away and nobody cared about me no more after they got what they wanted, I couldn't deal with that. I'll be an emotional wreck because I feel that what I give to people, and I feel I'm a good person to people. So I don't feel that people should do me like that, and I wouldn't want to do anyone else like that.
But well, do you see, in this time and age with middle school, do you see people really going there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Too much. Way too much.
And everything.
Well, I think middle school kids and like ninth graders do it just for the popularity and just to look cool and do what they do, but they don't know, like everybody else said, the consequences of doing that and what that person would think of you and the crowd that you hang out with. If they would think you're cool or you think you're dumb for doing that.
Yeah, and please get tested if you do something like that before you do it, not after the fact, but before. Yeah, always good after, but
so
before.
If you're already, you're giving
if you're sexually
about-
active, please to get tested and wear something. And females, they do have other things for you to wear if they don't want to wear it.
And know that those things can break and that they're not 100% foolproof.
Yeah,
and that
it's
there
just
is a chance you can get something
pregnancy
and that is not
pill.
Cute walking around with diseases. So you need to just know.
Yeah.
Yes.
And for the fellas,
go ahead.
For the fellas, don't go out there and try to be all hard because you think you just had it with a girl. But why would you do it? And you know that you ain't guaranteed to be with her for the rest of your life.
Yeah, exactly. Fellas, like what Reggie said, you can still get a girl pregnant, and if you do, don't just like run out on them because that's not cool.
Okay.
Yeah, don't run out because you got what you wanted and left her with your baby.
Okay, but I know that it's a word that is 100% preventable for all of this. And what's that word
abstinence
called?
Abstinence.
Yes. With that.
And if you do that, there's celibacy.
Celibate. Yep.
Being celibate.
Yes.
But you guys, look at the time. Our time is almost up.
Like
this
shout.
Hour
oh,
flew
man.
By. And I know I want to give you guys time enough to give your shout outs. Mm-hmm. So we're going to start off with Mr. Javari. If you can give your shout outs, please.
I'm Javari Tyler, and I want to give my shout outs to my dad, my father, my stepmother, my grandma, my grandpa, and all of them, and just like, yeah, and my cousins, and my dead grandpa, and all my folks at SCI, all my teachers, Miss Boston, Miss Honeycutt, much love, and Mr. McCarthy, even though he's not here with us tonight.
Okay. Sheree.
I would like to give some shout outs, my mother, my father, and my uncle, rest in peace, and my grandma and my aunties and my sisters, love you much.
Reggie?
I'd like to give a shout out to my mom, especially my mom and my dad, to my brother, especially my whole family and the whole SCI staff, and also like to give a shout out to my grandparents.
All right. Ashley.
All right, y'all. I want to give a shout out to my mom, my dad, my grandmother, my grandpa, my grandfather, my grandma, my teachers, my coordinators, Javarier, Bobo, my academy buddies, my coordinators, Stick, Shorty Doo-Wop, Nisha, Nini, Nye, Kiba, Sissy, Sunny, Shy, my boo, everybody, Don J, DJ, all you guys, I love you.
Okay, yes. And finally, yes. The last shout-out, Miss Boston.
To the world, hello. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Hello. This has been Teen Talk. You guys will be coming with you again next month. And as we say, standard number 7.
In SCI, we keep it real.
You know.
Bye.